Okay.
Great. Hi, everybody. I'm Melissa C. I'm a recovered compulsive overeater. I live in the best state, which is New York. Everybody knows that New York's the best state. So, with that, since there are so many new people, I'm gonna share my photos. If you've seen them a million times, you can take a snooze or not. But I like to share them with people, especially people who are new. And it really does apply to the chapter that I'm going to be talking about, the family afterward, because my family's in all of these pictures, just about. And the way that I interacted with my family was very much part of the problem, not just my physical form. But I like to share the pictures with people who are new to offer hope. Right? Because that's the purpose of coming together at a meeting, that we can give hope because we know that this disease is horrible and we've recovered, right? And so that gives us hope. And I like to show the pictures because it's a physical demonstration of what a miracle looks like. And I think I'm lucky that I had gotten so bad. How's that? I'm lucky that I got so bad because there's something that grabs the attention of people that could be helped, right? People tend to respond to something physical. So this was me when my daughter was first born. She's over 20 now. And I really thought that having a new baby was going to cure me of my disease of compulsive overeating, because I loved her and I loved my husband and I had this happy family. But here I am in the pink. She got older and I got larger. And I look at this picture and I see the hurt in my face. I see how much pain I was in. I could barely smile. My husband, lovingly, here he is, he's smiling, right? The pictures continue to go on. Our daughter between the two of us. We very often our family events were at restaurants. That's what we did together because that's what I could partake in. Those were the kinds of activities that I could do. And there was often drinking involved for me because drinking was very much a part, although I'm not an alcoholic, it was very much connected with the way that I ate. It sort of lowered my resistance. It made me not care at the moment, and it like got me like prepared to eat more. Here's me. I'm in the red. I'm actually at a party. There was a family party in my house. I did not look like I was hosting a party in any way. Could barely brush my hair at that point. Just felt horrible. And then next to it, I'm on a vacation. I had been abstinent, happy. I was on a vacation with my husband. And this was another one of those vacations that I ruined, because what happened was for me, I'd been abstinent at this point. I was happy. I had lost some weight. I was feeling great. And I picked up something on this vacation. For me, it's a drink. It was a drink. And then the rest of the vacation, I spent eating and not participating and miserable, miserable. This is me at my worst in the leopard sweater. This is my son. He's 14 now. I could barely hold him. I'm going to talk about the impact of the family to have a child, children that you love. I'm madly in love with my children. And I couldn't hold him. I could barely hold him. I could barely get my arms around him. And it broke my heart. And he also was extremely active and I couldn't keep up with him. So I would cry. And that's what I brought to this family. This is me and my sisters and my sister-in-laws. And I'm drinking, always drinking at these events. And I felt like, in a crowd, I have in a very big family, very loving, very big family, loud, opinionated, lot. We're a lot. We're a lot. And at these events, I ate. I ate and I ate and I ate. And I felt like I was all alone with the people that love me the most. And I was full of all the things that they did to me in my mind. This is me with my mom, big part of this story. But in this picture, I was actually recovered, even though I didn't look it in the gray dress. I'm actually recovered there. Just took my body a while to catch up. But this was a happy day because I had made a big, beautiful affair for my daughter's bas mitzvah and paid a ton of money for an open bar, a room, for dessert, like a whole room for dessert, and I ate none of it. And I was happy. How's that? Like I showed up. I wasn't annoyed. I felt like completely happy. And this picture was me and my mom last week. And I just took it because my mom is staying with me at this point. So this is the two of us now. And this is me. This is me. This is what I look like now. And the miracle is that those dresses all fit me. And that hasn't changed. That's just been my experience. So, all right. So I'm going to stop the sharing. And now I'm going to stop the sharing of the pictures. So hopefully that got a little bit of your attention, right? If you don't, if maybe it was enough to say, okay, maybe she knows something about this. And now I'm going to jump into the chapter. And hopefully I'll finish it. Otherwise, we'll kind of stop it and I'll talk about it at another point. But I'd like to get through as much as possible. So this is the chapter, The Family Afterward. And after what? Like after what? After we've recovered, right? This is what it looks like when we're in a family after we've gotten well, or on our way to getting well. On page 122, it says, wrapped in cotton wool and placed on a pedestal. Successful readjustment means the opposite. All members of the family should meet upon the common ground of tolerance, understanding, and love. This involves a process of deflation. So, this whole program is about deflation of self, of our ego. And the whole family doesn't have to treat us with kid gloves, right? They should not be afraid that we're going to binge if they just treat us like a regular family member. Our families don't afterwards, our families should not have to hide their stash of candy or tiptoe around us. In early abstinence, it might be that people give us a free pass, but that should not last for too long, because if that lasted for years and years and years, then we are growing more self-centered instead of less, right? And that's not release. That's relying on willpower. In a recovered state, this afterward period, we become a loving and tolerant parent, child, sister, brother, spouse, etc. And I think it's important for us to look at tolerance, because many of us think, or like I thought, that tolerance meant like I have to tolerate you, I have to stomach you, I have to like put up with you. And that's not how I see tolerance. Tolerance instead is diminished sensitivity. Just like we develop a tolerance to certain substances, people who have take a certain medication, sometimes they have to increase the dosage if you've built up a tolerance. That same kind of idea should happen about the things that used to trigger us, right? The idea is, I can't walk around this world getting rid of all the triggers. What I actually have to do is change myself, allow God to change me so that all those things don't trigger me, but they still exist. So that's what it really means to be tolerant, to diminish my own sensitivity. Page 122, it says, we find the more one member of the family demands that the others concede to him, the more resentful we become. And this makes for discord and unhappiness. And why, right? Is it not because each wants to play the lead? Is not each trying to arrange the family show to his liking? Is he not unconsciously trying to see what he can take from the family life rather than give? And so it makes me think, it really sounds just like being the stage director here. This really is in reference to that step three. And how, in being the stage director, we're forever trying to arrange everything to our liking. Why? Why do we do that? Is it because we want what's best for our families? Sometimes, yes. Sometimes I look at my family and say, well, I want to arrange everything because I know what's going to be good for them, right? But even that's flawed thinking, because Believing that I know what's best for my family and that I have all the answers, that's arrogant. Like, because really, what do I know? What do I know after all? I always say it like this: I don't even know how much food to eat. What makes me think I'm supposed to tell my sister how to live, my aunts, my mother-in-law, anybody, when I have to put food on a scale, right? So maybe I don't know as much as I think I know. And sometimes if I'm being really honest here, I don't always care so much what's in their best interest anyway. In a family, oftentimes we all want our things. We want everything our own way, right? But in recovery, I now have to look at the world from an entirely different angle. And it says here that so much of this is happening on an unconscious level, meaning it's not deliberate. So how do we work around this if this is unconscious and not deliberate? To me, this is why we pray. This is why we pray and ask God to help us be open to his direction. Because God gives us the inspiration and the intuitive thought. So if I'm operating on these unconscious ideas, what I need is God consciousness. I need God to get in there, right? And help me do things in agreement with him. This is why we pray. In the chapter Into Action on page 86, it says, before we begin, we ask God to direct our thinking, especially asking it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives. That's what it would be if I'm trying to arrange my family to my liking. That's self-seeking motives. So if I want to improve my relationships with my family, then I pray for them. Not that they bend to my will or that they do things my way, but rather my prayer is that I can be more useful for them. I pray, I ask God to help me be the daughter he wants me to be, help me be the mother he designed me to be. And I always thank God for assigning me this role. Right? I start off with a position of gratitude because if I have problems with people in my life, I better have a position of gratitude because it means I have people in my life, right? So that's a good starting point. And I also have complete confidence in God that he does not place me in the midst of trouble just because he likes to mess with me, right? Because I believe that God has a role for, he's assigned me a role, that he has these assignments picked out, and I want to thank him for what he's given me. So I've shared lots in the past, I've shared lots of prayers that I have for my children. I ask God's forgiveness where I've not been sensitive to their hurts and their needs for nurture, protection, care, and guidance. Sometimes I come to God in utter desperation, fear, and longing for my children. I ask God to help me deal with my emotional reactions and my confusion so I will do no harm. And then I ask Him to open my heart towards the heart of my child, that I can be objectively sensitive to their needs and pain. And I ask for insight into the reality of the world that they live in, because I don't know the world that they're living in, right? I only think I do. And I want insight into what they have to encounter daily. And then I say to God, I submit myself to you, embracing faith, hope, and love for the assignment of being a parent to this child. And I can do the same thing with all the different people in my life. Page 122, it says, years of living with an alcoholic is almost sure to make any wife or child neurotic, right? The entire family is to some extent ill. So if you look up neurotic, it means abnormally sensitive, obsessive, tense, and anxious. And I think it's kind of interesting that they're talking about the family being that way, because it sounds like they learned it from me, right? I mean, that's what it means to have been me, abnormally sensitive, obsessive, right? We're here because we have an obsession. Tense and anxious. So when you live with someone who's unpredictable, right? When your family or families live with us and we're unpredictable, we're up and down, we're wildly excited and then terribly depressed, it causes them to be tense. Even just when I used to swear off the foods, I would rid the house of junk. I'd make everybody promise to not bring it in and that to help me. I would say, don't let me eat this. Don't let me eat this. And then, that didn't work, right? Because human beings cannot be my shield. They can't be my obstacle. That can only come from God. So what would happen was I would start eating again and I would do it in secret, right? All the things that I made them throw out, now I was like hiding and doing it. And then suddenly I would just bring it back in the house again. And God help them if they said a word to me about it, right? That makes people nervous, tense, anxious. They don't know. They're like, well, she said to say something, but if I say something, she's gonna freak out on me, right? So if that's the way that I've impacted my family, I need to have tolerance for them when they show signs of being abnormally sensitive because I've helped make them that way. Page 123, the second paragraph, it says, it will take time to clear away the wreck. Though old buildings will eventually be replaced by finer ones, the new structures will take years to complete. So we're going to have to be patient and diligent. That's what we're going to have to be. And what replaces the wreck is a result of our amends. That's where the living amends come in, that we rebuild what was wrecked. And actually, we're told things are going to be even better than before. Like, isn't that great that we actually get to make it, even better? Page 124, it says, oh yeah, 123, the fourth paragraph. The first impulse will to bury these skeletons in a dark closet and padlock the door, right? So like I kind of want to hide the way that I've made a mess. That's like my first impulse. But thankfully, by this point, the family in the afterward, we're not slave to our impulses anymore, right? We're not like we were before. We're changed because God is helping us. And we know that there's something very powerful that happens when we pause. So my first impulse isn't, and when it's not aligned with God's will, my direction is, okay, pause. And there's something powerful that happens when I pause. Page 124 says, experience is the thing of supreme value in life. That is true only if one is willing to turn the past into good account. We grow by our willingness to face and rectify errors and convert them into assets. The alcoholic's past thus becomes the principal asset of the family, and frequently it is almost the only one. And then that this is one of my favorites. It says, cling to the thought that in God's hands, the dark past is the greatest possession you have, the key to life and happiness for others. With it, you can avert death and misery for them. Just think that's incredible. That's why I share my pictures. They're not the skeleton in the closet. I don't want to hide what it was like before. Why? Because I believe that this is a great possession. My past is a great possession because it helps others. It can give them life and happiness. So we're going to get to have better lives than before, right? We get these better lives. All of the garbage of our past, all the terrible things we've done, we don't have to be ashamed. We don't have to hide the truth. We don't have to hide our experiences, even the bad ones. Our experience can save people's lives. What this tells me is that this was not all just a great big waste after all. If you find yourself saying things like, oh gosh, I should have gotten it earlier. I wished I would have gotten it earlier. If only I'd gotten better earlier, right? I wasted all those years when my children were babies. You're not thinking, right? You're not looking at it that it wasn't a waste. I say, like, all that experience that I had, it was my internship. It was my on-the-job training, because every single one of those experiences, if properly looked at, can be helpful for other people. We can share them with other people. I say it's like God takes the trash and he reshapes it and turns it into good. And I think about, like, as a second grade teacher, I always used to do this project with my kids where they'd bring in recyclables from home and then they would make something with it, like this idea you should do on an Earth Day. But and it's funny, my daughter likes to do this with, like, clothes. She likes to go to the thrift shop and she says, I'm upcycling it, right? So she, like, takes stuff and she makes it even better, right? Old stuff, and makes it even better. And that's what God does with our lives. Just takes the stuff that looks like it's garbage and, like, upcycles it, makes it even better. Bottom of page 124. It is possible to dig up past misdeeds so they become a blight, a veritable plague. A few of us have had these growing pains and they hurt a great deal. We think that unless some good and useful purpose is to be served, past occurrences should not be discussed. So what does that mean? They're really talking in this part of the text about infidelities, but we know that we treat sex like any other problem. So this is the same for any problem. Any other behaviors that anybody in my family or myself did, if we say it's forgiven, we don't keep bringing it up. If we have truly forgiven people, we say that they've been forgiven, then we leave it to rest. And if forgiveness is difficult, if you yourself are having a problem with forgiveness, that's not your family's problem. That's your problem. That's your problem. And thankfully, we have a process for it. We've got inventory, and we pray. If we're struggling to forgive someone, now some things people have done are might be, horrible, horrible. But if we allow them to take up space and we keep re-bringing them up to those people, we're keeping them alive and well, right? And there's a difference between forgiveness and oh gosh, I can't think of the word, but forgiveness and
Reconciliation.
thank you, and reconciliation. So just because I forgive someone does not mean that I'm going to be in relationship with them anymore. In fact, sometimes that's the very best choice, is to no longer be in relationship with them. No longer give yourself this open, like, I'm your victim, right? It's not good for them and it's not good for you. But if we say we forgive people, we don't keep bringing it up. My daughter did something years ago. She said she was sorry. It's done. It's done. It's forgiven. And if there's something that needs further work, that will be between, that's up to God. I'm not the judge. I'm not the judge. So, page 125, it says a man may criticize or laugh at himself, and it will affect others favorably. And I think it's incredible that we really can laugh at ourselves. And it's helpful to others when we don't take ourselves so seriously. That's beneficial. But criticism or ridicule coming from another often produces the contrary effect. So it's not okay for me to laugh at your flaws, at your difficulties. But if I can laugh at my own, that's great. Members of a family should watch such matters carefully. For one careless, inconsiderate remark has been known to raise the very devil. We alcoholics are sensitive people. It takes some of us a long time to outgrow this serious handicap. So we're careful, right? I am extremely sensitive. I've been extremely sensitive, which is self-centered, by the way. When you're overly sensitive, it means you're overly concerned with yourself. Addicts, we get offended easily. We take things personally. That doesn't disappear overnight. We should remember that our families, by the way, have learned how to respond to inconsiderate remarks from watching how we respond. So if we want them to not be so sensitive, we have to stop modeling that overly sensitive demeanor. You know, we've got to cut them some slack and be careful with criticism, right? And I know for me, oh boy, that's hard. It's hard to stop criticizing, right? It's hard, especially when it comes to parenting, because I think, well, I'm just helping. I'm pointing it out, right? But some things, it's not really, especially if I pointed it out before, that's called nagging, right? You get to point it out maybe once. And more than that, you become a nag. Many alcoholics, now it goes on to say many alcoholics are enthusiasts. They run to extremes. At the beginning of recovery, a man will take, as a rule, one of two directions. He's either going to plunge into a frantic attempt to get on his feet in business, or he may be so enthralled by his new life that he talks or thinks of little else. In either case, certain family problems will arise. With these, we've had experiences galore. So for myself, I'll tell you, it wasn't necessarily to like get back on my feet economically, because I never suffered job-wise from this disease. Now, I wasn't a great, I got into fights with people at work. I got into a lot of arguments over things. But I was a good employee. I worked very hard and I never lost my job. But when I got well, first, I began to be obsessed by healthy eating. I was body focused, you know, or else on fire and entirely focused on the 12 steps, which is great, right? But both can leave the family wondering where they fit in, you know, and we don't want to leave our families with this, where are they going to fit in our lives now? Page 127, it says the family must realize that dad, though marvelously improved, is still convalescing. So we're still getting well. They should be thankful he's sober and able to be of this world once more. Let them praise his progress. Let them remember that his drinking brought all kinds of damage that may take long to repair. If they sense these things, they will not take so seriously his periods of crankiness, depression, or apathy, which will disappear when there's love, tolerance, and spiritual understanding. So, okay, we're going to be cranky at times, and so will our family. But we can't take it so seriously, right? We've got to be okay when people are cranky. To me, this chapter really illuminates the need for getting thicker skinned. That I just keep seeing it all over the place, that the key to happiness in your family afterwards is to grow a little thicker skinned. Sensitivity is really self-centeredness. That's what it is. When you perceive everything in the world as it's happening to you, that means all you're concerned about is you. And now it goes on to say, since the home has suffered more than anything else, it is well that a man exert himself there. He is not likely to get far in any direction if he fails to show unselfishness and love under his own roof. You know, it says there's difficult wives and families, right? We've got some difficulties in our families, but the man who was getting over alcoholism must remember he did much to make them so. This chapter really reminds us that if we're not happy with the way things are in our family, we have to look at ourselves, that we contributed to this. And I have to say, the place where I behaved the worst was always in the privacy of my own home, in my small, immediate family. I was kind to strangers. I put a smile on my face. I baked cupcakes for the PTA. I was the Girl Scout leader, so I spent time with everyone else's kids. Right? Oh, I was so great. I was so, oh, I'll do this and I'll do that. But I gave my family the worst of me, right? And this must be addressed in the family afterward. We must be the kinds of mothers, wives, daughters, etc., that God intended us to be. It's not so spiritual of me to ignore my family, to work with sponsees. I have to tell you, like, if my child needs me for something, and I know we have to give a lot to this program, but if something, and I always tell people this, I have children, and if something comes up that's an immediate that they require me, I know God assigned me the role of mother. I have to tend to that. I must tend to that first, right? And like currently right now, I've got my mom here with me. We brought my mom up from Florida, where my sister and I are really working. It's incredible what happens to the family afterwards. We have decided that the two of us have no problem. We're going to take care of our mom, and we're in such agreement to it. We say we're kind of like splitting custody. Like we were divorced, and we're gonna, and my mother's so happy with that. We gave like each other a big, three of us gave each other a big hug. Now, this week, I have to be honest, I have not been as there for my sponsees, but I'm working this out with my mom, and I don't believe that God would have me. This is my mother. She raised me. She's 86 years old. I couldn't possibly ignore her to tend to other people. To call back everybody that called me. I know that that would be wrong. I know that that would be wrong. Page 127 says family talks will be constructive if they can be carried on without heated argument, self-pity, self-justification, or resentful criticism. So when we have to discuss things with our families, we have to be looking to build up, not tear down, and we're gentle in our demeanor and in our words. So if I'm not able to talk without arguing or harboring resentments, right, then we're supposed to pause. We're supposed to wait until our emotional sobriety is back in check. And I always know that I get into trouble when I am acting in anger, when I fire off my mouth in anger. I'm supposed to wait and not act in anger. You know, and page 127, 128 says, giving rather than getting will become the guiding principle. And I love this. Guiding principles are the principles that guide any organization, right? I'm the organization right now, throughout life in all circumstances. So if this is my guiding principle, then it means that I'm supposed to be giving, even if stuff is going on, right? And it tells me that regardless of what's going on, I'm gonna remain giving. This is what it means to be other-centered. And it's not just in the fellowship, this is in our family. Page 128 says, assume, on the other hand, that Father has at the outset a stirring spiritual experience. Overnight, as it were, he's a different man. He becomes a religious enthusiast. He's unable to focus on anything else. As soon as his sobriety begins to be taken as a matter of course, the family may look at their strange new dad with apprehension, like an irritation, you know, because there's talk about spiritual matters, morning, noon, and night. And it says at the bottom of the page, we've indulged in spiritual intoxication. It's like we've gotten drunk on God, on the spiritual intoxication. And like a gaunt prospector. So we think about this like we're starving. We come here, we're spiritually starving. We're these prospectors, we're like mining for it. And then we hit it, we get it, right? And we strike gold.